It's Wednesday, September 18th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. The presidential candidacy of Andrew Yang has occasionally drawn from offensive Asian American stereotypes.
Senator Becker, now, I am Asian, so I know a lot of doctors.
Some Asian Americans are put off by Yang's rhetoric, and we'll ask what issues matter most to Asian American voters heading into 2020. Also on the show, Republican Mark Sanford on why he's challenging Donald Trump in 2020 and his concerns over a number of states canceling their GOP primaries.
Obviously, in some countries you have coronations, in others you have a coup d'etat that brings in political power, in others you have fixed or rigged elections. That's not the American tradition. The American tradition is to go ahead and debate ideas.
And two meteorologists explain how they're telling local viewers that climate change is happening in their neck of the woods.
I think everyone has a role to play in talking about climate change, and my role is to stay a trusted messenger and to stick to the science.
First up, Asian Americans and the race for 2020. This year's field of Democratic presidential hopefuls is one of the most racially diverse in United States history. And while the debate stages have been crowded with governors, members of Congress, and mayors, one of the most surprising contenders has been Andrew Yang, an entrepreneur with no political background. Yang, a first-generation Taiwanese-American, is not expected to make the final round, and yet his campaign has highlighted issues affecting Asian-American voters here and abroad.
My father grew up on a peanut farm in Asia with no floor, and now his son is running for president. That is the immigration story that we have to be able to share with the American people.
He's banked his long-shot candidacy on a promise to pass a universal basic income, and his poll numbers and fundraising efforts have qualified him for the next round of debates in October. But the increase in attention is bringing in further scrutiny to his remarks on his Asian American identity, which some say have enforced insidious stereotypes.
Senator Becker,
now, I am Asian, so I know a lot of doctors.
I'm Asian, so you know I love to work.
Asian Americans make up the fourth largest racial group in the country, and while the term Asian American is very broad, the group itself is ethnically and economically diverse. Pew Research data from 2018 shows that roughly 65% of Asian Americans identify as or lean Democratic, and 27% identify as or lean Republican. But Yang is not the only Asian American candidate running for the Democratic nomination in 2020. Former California prosecutor Kamala Harris's Indian American heritage on her mother's side sometimes gets overlooked. But as Democratic candidates like Yang and Harris are starting to change the conversation, that still doesn't mean that the main political concerns within Asian American communities are being addressed on the national political stage. Joining me now to talk more about this is Arun Venugopal, a reporter for WNYC, who has long covered race and immigrant communities, including South Asian communities. Arun, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Alton Wang is an Asian American community organizer based in Los Angeles. Alton, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Alton, let's start with you. Some of the comments from Andrew Yang that we mentioned at the top of the show seem to be on their face self-deprecating jokes, and they're delivered like jokes, but you see them as harmful. Tell us why.
You're right. They seem like self-deprecating jokes, but what they really are perpetuations of the model minority myth, and they're examples of that myth being implemented. And they're really being used in a way that I think is making him seem palatable to non-Asians instead of really using his platform as a way to elevate issues that are impacting Asian Americans. And that really is dangerous and exploitative of our communities, and it's really making it harder to grasp the struggles and dilemmas that many in our community are facing today.
Let's dig a little deeper into that, because often when we talk about racial stereotypes, there are folks that might say, well, the model minority stereotype for Asian Americans is a positive stereotype, right? And they're lacking the understanding of how the trope actually operates and what effects it has on the racial discourse. So could you sort of guide us through that, Alton?
Absolutely. I think you're right there that it seems like a positive stereotype that really is thinking about Asian American communities as pinnacles of achievement and success in this country. But what the real problem with this stereotype and this myth is the origins of it really is rooted in creating racial discord in this country. You know, it comes from a 1966 article written by sociologist William Peterson that pits the Asian American model minority with the black problem minority in his words. words. And this really rests not on the laurels of Asian American success, but instead of the oppression of other communities of color, specifically Black oppression and perceived cultural failure of these communities. And it really is, you know, trying to distinguish what, you know, communities of color in America at the time and today are and what they quote unquote could be in comparison to Asian American communities. So this positive stereotype does not really only rest on the ideas of Asian American success, but really relies on the quote unquote failure of other communities of color to really operate.
Arun, the conversation this week has sort of centered on East Asian Americans, but what about the South Asian community? What's their take on, or at least broadly, on what the conversation has been this week?
Oh, I think what you're seeing right now is we have an impending visit by Prime Minister Narendra Modi from India arriving here, and this is drawing out a lot of tensions as well as passions from certain segments of the Indian American population, which is increasingly influential, increasingly inserting itself into politics, but it's also stirring up all kinds of complicated issues of identity, foreign policy. The Prime Minister is arriving here after there was a crackdown in the area of Kashmir in India that is inserting itself actually into American politics. There are people who are having to take stands on these issues, and these are very complicated and thorny issues to take stands on, and that's driving up a lot of passions in ways that we might not have expected even a few weeks ago. At the same time, you have people like Kamala Harris who are coming out. She just launched an outreach effort called South Asians for the People. It comes, I think, as she is no longer quite the front runner that she was a couple months ago. So is that just coincidence, or is it sort of a reflection of the fact that she needs to appeal to every single community, including one that hasn't necessarily received the attention that you might have expected, given that her mom is of Indian heritage?
And has she resonated with Asian American voters so far? Because a lot of the conversation around Kamala Harris has been about her Blackness and having gone to a historically Black college, Howard. But a lack of it has really been on that Indian heritage that she has. So I'm wondering, has there been a connection there?
It's interesting. I saw her a year ago at an event. It was sort of like a reception or a gala for a nonprofit. And she spoke with real fluency about her heritage and her visits to India. And I think that the campaign hasn't made of it what it could have. And I think there's certain ways in which the discourses shape around certain stories, more so in her case around the Black side of her family and her Blackness growing up. I have not seen the level of engagement or enthusiasm that one might have expected, given that she is the only person in the presidential race who is of Indian heritage at all. I think there is a certain contingent in the community, the Indian community that is, that was excited, has been excited about Tulsi Gabbard, who is not Indian, but she's Hindu. She's had very strong ties with a section of the Hindu community in America and with leaders in India. That's been exciting. They gave her a lot of money early on. And at the same time, I think amongst progressive South Asians and Indian Americans, there has been some questions like, okay, does she represent us? Does her record as a prosecutor in some ways, is it a misstep, or does she have a bad record when it comes to issues of criminal justice and other issues? And I think that's something you're seeing across the board with voters, especially on the left.
Alton, let's dig a little deeper into that point that Arun just made in terms of what various issues that Asian American communities are looking to have addressed in this election cycle that aren't being addressed, you think, so far.
Well, you know, I think that one misconception that people might have is that Asian Americans have a specific set of issues that's different from the general American politic. But really, Asian Americans care about issues that all Americans care about. But, you know, some of the specific issues that really are at the forefront of the mindsets of Asian American voters in this cycle are things like immigration. You know, Asian Americans are one of the largest immigrant groups in the country, and there are more immigrants coming to the United States today from the Asia Pacific region than anywhere else in the world. So all the conversations we have about restricting legal immigration and these recent attacks on public charge are really striking fear in Asian American communities. So some of these issues, like immigration, are really at the forefront of our minds going into this next cycle.
Arun, you wanted to make a point there.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there is some really great data that's come out of the National Asian American Survey, both in 2016 and 2018, and they put certain questions to Asian American voters, and they disaggregate that by nationality. One question was, should undocumented immigrants have a pathway to citizenship? And the majority clearly said, yes, they should. Within Asian American voters, it was 54%, same with Vietnamese Americans. Amongst Asian Indians, 76% said yes, they should have a pathway. Affirmative action, you see some differences. Most people are supportive of it, but it depends. 38% of Chinese Americans say it's a good thing. 78% of Asian Indians say it's a good thing. So you see, again, like what Alton's been getting at, the diversity within the community. But on some of these issues, there is generally a progressive tilt.
And it's interesting you mention affirmative action, Arun, because when I think about that, I think about the Harvard lawsuit case that's being fought right now and the fights here in New York City and specialized schools that have really brought younger Asian Americans to the fore in terms of this political conversation. Alton, this conversation goes beyond Andrew Yang and Kamala Harris and Tulsi Gabbard, but when we think about Yang on the stage and Harris on the debate stage, I mean, this is the first time that I can recall seeing this level of Asian American political dialogue on the national stage. How is that moving the narrative forward, if at all?
It definitely is moving the narrative forward. You know, we so often talk about the bamboo ceiling that is impacting Asian Americans in terms of rising to levels of leadership in this country, whether we're talking about the C-suite or we're talking about politics. And I think both of these candidates are doing a really critical job at breaking that bamboo ceiling at the highest levels of, you know, American leadership. So there is a significant role being played there. But with that, there is a lot of responsibility. You know, that moment in the spotlight for Andrew Yang, or, you know, for the last few decades for Senator Harris, really goes to show not only what Asian Americans can contribute to this country, but more importantly for them, I think it has to show what they can do for our community as well.
Arun, on that point, I mean, we mentioned Kamala Harris having some sort of outreach now to South Asian communities, but are other campaigns looking to do the same? Have we heard about anyone besides Harris who's really trying to make an outreach effort to the Asian American voter bloc?
Yeah, just a couple of days ago, Joe Biden's campaign announced that it had started an Asian American Pacific Islander outreach effort under a New Jersey resident, Amit Jani. Ro Khanna, congressman who represents Silicon Valley, very progressive. He is the co-chair, I think, of Bernie Sanders' campaign. And he has also, I guess, is taking a lot of heat for comments he made, which are essentially he and Bernie Sanders have made about the Kashmir issue. It's getting a major backlash. So there are the pros and cons of having these kinds of issues stirred up. It's because there are not monolithic responses to these things. I think it was interesting just yesterday or so, there was a paper called the India Herald, which had a headline saying, Hindu Americans feel betrayed by leftist Democrats. So this is playing into larger issues like these communities, at least Indians, are highly democratic, but they definitely want the bang for their buck.
Alton, last question for you, pivoting just a minute. We've got about a minute left. There's a dust-up with SNL's firing of comedian Shane Gillis for making a number of racist comments about Asians. Yang decided that he would invite him to have a sit-down. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I really think that that was quite troubling. You know, these comments and the acceptance of these jokes by Andrew Yang really is perpetuating not just the model minority myth, but this idea of Asian Americans as the perpetual foreigner, that we don't belong here, that it's okay to make jokes about Asian Americans. And I think that that is a constant struggle for our community to, you know, just appear to be American and to have a role in the broader American political discourse. And so these jokes aren't just not funny, but they really are damaging to our community as a whole.
Alton Wang is Asian American community organizer based in LA, and Arun Venugopal is a reporter for WNYC. Thanks so much to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And for our Asian American listeners, we want you to weigh in on this. What issues are on your mind ahead of the 2020 elections, and do you feel represented in local or national politics?
Hey, this is Jen in Austin, Texas. I don't plan on voting for Andrew Yang, but I do like him, and it makes me so happy to see an Asian American doing really well in the presidential race. This representation is long overdue, and I'm grateful for him and his progressive platform. I know my grandmother would be proud.
Thanks so much for weighing in. You can keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Heading into 2020, so far, much of the focus has been on who the Democrats will choose to run against Donald Trump. But on the GOP side, three Republican candidates are running their own campaigns against the president. Former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, and former Illinois Representative Joe Walsh. Last week, the three wrote a collective op-ed in the Washington Post condemning South Carolina, Kansas, Arizona, and Nevada for canceling their respective Republican primaries and effectively handing President Trump the Republican nomination in those states. In the op-ed, the candidates wrote, quote, "Do Republicans really want to be the party with a nominating process that more resembles Russia or China than our American tradition?" But the decision to cancel the incumbent party's primaries is not exactly a break from tradition. Arizona and South Carolina canceled their primaries for Democratic presidential candidates in 1996 and in 2012. And South Carolina has also canceled previous primaries for Republican presidential candidates, including in 2004. Joining me now is former South Carolina governor and 2020 Republican presidential candidate Mark Sanford. Governor Sanford, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
My pleasure.
So why do you think this group of states, South Carolina, Nevada, Kansas, and Arizona, canceled their primaries? I mean, how are they able to do that?
Well, you know, committees can do what they can do, but in the case of South Carolina, they're actually breaking their own bylaws in doing so. To have done this, they would have needed to do it 2 years ago, which is to say it's open to legal challenge, and I and others are going to look at that. The bigger thing, though, is why would they do it politically? Because if Donald Trump has this supposed 90% edge in Republican circles, in the world of politics, you take a win. You take it particularly if it's the first in the South primary, which South Carolina is, and you run with it based on its implications in other states. The fact that they're not doing that says that somebody's looking at numbers that say that the president's support is indeed a mile wide, but perhaps an inch deep.
Now, Governor, you were governor in South Carolina when the state canceled the GOP primary in 2004, and that was when George Bush was the incumbent president. Were you against canceling the primary then?
I didn't really particularly focus on it simply because nobody was running against him. I mean, it's one thing to cancel a primary based on there being no other alternative. In some cases, that could be logical, money savings. But the Post and Courier, which is the paper of the coast of South Carolina, based here in Charleston, editorialized against what the state executive committee just did. Because, one, it's not money-saving. They could actually hold the primary on the same day that the Democrats do and do it at no cost. So it's not a money-saver. This is purely about circling the wagons to protect the president. And it is a very different scenario to cancel a primary when no one is running against the incumbent. It is a very different one when you have a two-term governor of that state, somebody who'd been in the House of Representatives for 12 years, someone who has built previous political organizations in the state that have been successful in two governorship races. That's a very different scenario.
You and the other candidates who are running against the president wrote a collective op-ed in the Washington Post last week in which you wrote, quote, "It would be a critical mistake to allow the Democratic Party to dominate the national conversation during primary and caucus season." Why do you think that is?
Because ideas should matter in the world of politics. It ought to be based on more than simple tribalism or brute force. I mean, obviously in some countries you have coronations, in others you have a coup d'etat that brings in political power, in others you have fixed or rigged elections. That's not the American tradition. The American tradition is to go out and debate ideas. And so there's a robust debate taking place on the Democratic side as to what it means to be a Democrat. What are the ideals that Democrats should hold dear? Where are we going as a party? That's healthy. We believe that there ought to be a concurrent debate on the Republican side as to what it means to be a Republican, because some of what the president has done, I don't think is in any way consistent with what the Republican Party has historically stood for.
You mentioned the robust debate that's happening on the Democratic side. There have already been three debates on stage with the various candidates who are running for president in the Democratic Party. Let's say the president, you know, there have been talk about whether or not the president will actually show up for a debate. Are you worried about that?
Of course. I suspect he won't. I mean, his style is more autocratic. He talks about different third world despots that he admires based on, quote, strength in a raw political sense rather than a democratic sense. So it would not surprise me at all if he said, well, you know, I'm not doing that, because at times that's the way bullies behave. They'll put up a strong front, but then they don't want to throw their ideas out in the public square and actually compare and contrast and debate them.
Now, Governor, are you hopeful that either your own message or the message of the other two folks who are running against the president will resonate with the current Republican Party voters at this point? I mean, the president currently has a significant amount of support among the GOP voter base. And I mean, do you think it's too late to turn that message around?
Well, I'll put it this way. Politics are comparative. They're relative. There is no perfect candidate out there as the encapsulation of every ideal that you might hold or that I might hold. And so if the simple question for most South Carolina Republicans, just using them as a litmus test, is it Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, I will predict with about 90% certainty, which is about where his numbers fall, that most Republicans in South Carolina would say, I'm going with Donald Trump. If, however, you have a real choice between some other folks that have varied backgrounds, I mean, Bill Weld is from the Northeast and Joe is from the Midwest and I'm a Southern guy with differing political pedigrees and different voting records, then you're going to see some things splinter. Because I went to a University of South Carolina football game a week ago, and it was amazing to me, and that's solid Trump territory. I mean, very solid Trump territory. The number of people who came up, I said, hey, I just heard about the election being canceled. I can't believe that. I want to be able to have my voice. I want a choice. I want to be a part of this debate. I do think you're going to see those numbers diminish. A snapshot, a poll is simply a snapshot in time. And the snapshot that was taken, I don't think, is reflective of what we'll see as we go a couple months into this thing.
Why do you think President Trump should not be elected in 2020?
For a host of reasons, but I would begin at a most basic level in that Milton Friedman once said that the ultimate measure of government is what it spends. Now, that's not the only measure, but it's an important barometer. And so traditionally, Republicans stood for financial sanity, not getting ahead of your skis on spending, financial prudence. If you look at polling and data out there, it says that traditionally folks have trusted the Republican Party on pocketbook issues. I think he's thrown the pocketbook and the wallet out the door. And if you look at his spending, it's well beyond and above President Obama's. You look at deficits are projected to be over $1 trillion a year over the next 10 years. You look at the debt, it's at record numbers. And I think he's taking us over the cliff. He has said, I'm the king of debt. Well, he always had his dad there to bail him out at critical moments that would have killed out most real estate entrepreneurs as they were getting started. He didn't get killed out because his dad was there. We're not so lucky as American taxpayers. And so I think the debt and spending issue is big. I think that where he's taken us in trade is a mistake. I think where he's taken us with regard to respect and trust in institutions that have been part of the glue that have held our system together for more than 200 years is in the wrong direction. And I think his tone is off. And I saw that right here in this congressional district that I used to represent, wherein millennials, working women, stay-at-home moms in droves turned out against him as a proxy. And as a result, for the first time in about 50 years, this Republican district went Democrat.
Governor Sanford, while you were serving as governor in 2009, you made headlines for essentially disappearing for about a week. And your members of your staff were concerned about your whereabouts, and eventually that led to being revealed that you were having an extramarital affair. Do you think voters can trust you now, particularly voters that remember that scandal?
I think there are two key elements there. One is, Are you sorry for what you did? In contrast to the president, who said there's nothing in life that he's sorry for, if you talk to voters down here, you'll hear of an apology tour. You'll hear of a lot of conversation I had with folks saying, I'm very sorry for letting you down. And in the wake of all those conversations, you can have a level of humility, a level of empathy, as a result of failure. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we all have feet of clay, and there's some chapter of life that we wish we could redo, but that's not how life works. And what's interesting about that is, in the wake of that, finished out my term as governor, but a couple years later, this congressional seat on the coast came open, and I was elected to it. And so people back home said, you know, I don't like how you handle that chapter of life. You made a mistake, but we know you and we trust you, and we're going to send you to be our emissary to Washington as a member of Congress. That's a very humbling journey to go on. So I'd say, one, did you learn from it, or is it just sort of the way you roll? The other thing I think is interesting is I think it's important in life not to judge people based on their best day any more than it is to judge them on their worst day. And do you see a pattern here? And that's why, again, I think a lot of folks back home said, no, we know who you are, and this is not consistent with who you are. That's why we're going to send you back to Congress.
Mark Sanford is the former governor of South Carolina and a 2020 Republican candidate for president. Governor Sanford, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
My pleasure.
Lows tonight, down into the 80s to low 90s.
The big storm that's dropped 2 to 3 feet of snow in the mountains is letting up now. Still some lingering light snow showers.
Now, as we take a look at tonight, it's looking great. We're in the 80s now, 87 at 6 p.m., 82 at 8.
Sound familiar? Local TV weather broadcasters are some of the most trusted people in media. We rely on them during hurricanes and snowstorms, but also to tell us if we need an umbrella before heading to the office or what the weekend weather has in store. But as the effects of climate change grow and our weather becomes more extreme, some local weather forecasts are also sounding more like this.
We are talking about the warmest temperatures in the spring seasons, getting warmer and warmer by the year. In fact, this is the latest from Climate Central, and you analyze the data since 1970, and a warming by as much as 5.5 degrees.
Climate change is real, folks, and is being caused by the increase in carbon dioxide and methane in our atmosphere.
That was Amber Sullins, chief meteorologist for ABC 15 News in Phoenix, and Mike Nelson, chief meteorologist at Denver 7. And they're part of a small but growing number of meteorologists who are addressing climate change during their local weather broadcasts. And Amber and Mike join me now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So, Amber, let's start with you. When did you first start talking about climate change during your weather forecasts?
It was back in 2013. It was right after I had my daughter, my second child, and I was seeing the changes that were happening in my hometown of Phoenix and just becoming more sensitive to what life would look like in the decades ahead for my kids.
Mike, what about you?
Similar story, except I'm a little older than Amber, so it was with the birth of my first grandchild in 2012.
And Mike, what are some of the ways that you incorporate climate change into what can sometimes be a short spot during the news?
That is one of the challenges we have, is oftentimes you get a 2.5 to 3 minute window to talk about everything. So how do you slide climate change in there? And it's actually not as difficult as you might think. If you know that your producer has a story leading into weather that maybe is about the fire season or the drought or whatever, you can lead that into maybe a quick 30 or 60 second little primer on climate change, just talking about, you know, the trends that we're seeing, what we would expect to see with a warmer world. We'll get more drought, we'll get more wildfire seasons that are longer. I recently did an explainer showing the 4 national parks in Colorado and how the temperature had risen in the 100 years since the national park system was developed. And for instance, in Rocky Mountain National Park, we've seen an increase in temperature of about almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the past century. And looking ahead, the climate of Denver in the next 50 to 70 years will become more like that of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Amber, what about you in terms of how you're able to bring this issue to light in sometimes pretty short spots during the news?
Yeah, very similar to what Mike said. I take the daily weather forecast and I use that as an opportunity to talk about climate and give my viewers a perspective on what's happening. So, for example, this summer was incredibly hot here in Phoenix. And so I dug into that data and I showed this is how many 110 degree or hotter days we've had. This is what's normal. This is how many more we've had since the 1970s or 80s. So I put those numbers into perspective. perspective for my viewers. And, you know, for example, we had highs at 115 degrees this summer a couple of times. So I dug down into that data and I showed that prior to 1960, we were only seeing about 7 115 or hotter days every 20 years. And now just since the year 2000, in this 20-year period, we've seen 42.
It's pretty amazing to think about that. And, you know, this is something, the topic, as we all know, is something that's being hotly contested in a lot of our political circles. And I'm wondering if either of you have gotten pushback from people who watch your station or management at your stations on what you're doing.
Well, I think everyone has a role to play in talking about climate change. And my role is to stay a trusted messenger and to stick to the science. And as long as I'm doing that, there's not a whole lot of pushback that can occur because I'm really just presenting the facts.
We try and keep it strictly scientific and just go with the facts, explain to people the thermodynamics behind this, and it's way more physical science than it is political science, what we're trying to convey. And I will say, and I think Amber would concur, that every time I mention climate change, I will get my handful, and it's usually the same people that accuse me of politicizing the weather report, but I get 20 emails to every one saying thank you for talking about this. Every weathercaster ought to be at least putting some emphasis of this into their weathercast. We are trusted by our audience, and studies show way beyond where most journalists come in. The television weathercaster is the one that delivers you the severe thunderstorm warnings, the flash flood warnings, and there is a layer of trust. We're also out in the grade schools talking to the kids. Not only that, but people invite us into their living rooms. And so it gives us a great opportunity to teach good climate science, but I think also a responsibility to teach good climate science.
Also, you know, you mentioned trust, and that's something that gets built up over time. Both of you, Amber, you've been at ABC 15 since 2009, and Mike, you've been a weather forecaster for 40 years. That's four decades now. Do you think that folks who are just starting out in the business, who are new to meteorology or journalism in this particular area, are going to feel as comfortable as you all do talking about this?
It's a little daunting because if you're a brand new meteorologist, say someone that's 30 years old and maybe you have a child or two that are very young and you're brand new in a market and you start to talk about climate change and somebody sends an email saying, now you're politicizing the weather reports and I'm not going to watch you anymore, and they copy that to your boss, that can be scary. And it's frankly, it's bullying because the number of people that are that loud about it and that skeptical is getting smaller, but unfortunately getting a little bit louder. And so part of what Amber and I have tried to do with the Station Scientist Committee is to encourage and inspire the younger weathercasters to be able to talk about this in a way that will not get them in hot water with the majority of their viewers.
Yeah, and there are lots of early career professionals out there, early career meteorologists that know about this science or are hungry to learn more about it and can find creative ways to incorporate it. And that could also help build the trust that they want to receive from their viewers if they are able to provide that extra perspective on the weather story of the day.
Do you both think that the people who watch your broadcast have started thinking maybe a little differently about climate change since you've started bringing it up?
Yeah, I know they have. They write in emails, they post on my Facebook page, and I think that's where we also have an opportunity to go beyond, you know, the 30 seconds that we're given in a newscast to talk about this stuff. It happens so quickly on TV that we, you know, sometimes take the opportunity to expand on that on Facebook posts or through Twitter or any other kind of social media. And I've seen a lot of conversations over the years and viewers that are genuinely inquisitive and want to know what's happening. And while it may start out kind of skeptical, I have seen firsthand changes in people that as they ask more questions and as I provide them the answers, it kind of gets the wheels spinning in their head, so to speak, and they start to think about these things on a deeper level and then search out the other answers they're looking for when we're talking about possible solutions.
Mike Nelson is chief meteorologist at Denver 7, and Amber Sullins is chief meteorologist for ABC 15 News in Phoenix. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very
much. Our pleasure.
All week, we've been bringing you stories of climate change in the lead up to the UN Climate Action Summit next week as part of a collaboration with 250 other media organizations called Covering Climate Now. You can find all of our coverage at thetakeaway.org/coveringclimatenow. And of course, you can give us a call about anything at 877-8MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.